I never advocate that a company should say, hey, HR, this is your responsibility to change culture. Or I often kind of cringe when I see people in charge of culture inside of an organization, because no one person can be in charge of culture, really, other than the CEO. Ultimately, the CEO is the one who's going to set the tone and make this happen. But it takes a village, and it takes a lot of people to make it happen.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and build heart-healthy organizations with a culture of purpose, trust, and integrity. I'm your host, Tobias Tudorsson, and I'm the co-founder of Hearts Management. I think it's becoming increasingly clear that the way we approach culture change isn't working. Perhaps part of the problem is in the term culture change itself. As we learned in an earlier episode with Ed and Peter Schein, we often have a naive approach to culture and a faulty belief that we can easily change it. I've heard countless times from well-meaning leaders who have merged to different companies that they now want to build one culture. The idea is that by identifying a few shared values, the culture of these two organizations will almost automatically turn into one, something that is doomed to fail. These assumptions around the term culture change are why I was so excited when Kevin Oakes introduced the word culture, or the term culture renovation. Kevin is the CEO of I4CP, a leading HR research firm. He is the author of Culture Renovation, 18 Leadership Actions to Build an Unshakable Company. Dr. Brené Brown calls it the best playbook I've seen when it comes to creating organizational cultures that create competitive advantage. I know that many of you are HR and ethics professionals or leaders who need tools to build healthy cultures. Therefore, I was so thrilled to sit down with Kevin and dig deep into the strategies and actions that they, through really extensive research, have learned are key to successfully renovating culture.
So, Kevin, it's a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You have a long and successful career within the business world as founder, CEO, and board member of several different ventures. Where did your interest for culture start, and what made you ultimately decide to focus your professional life and work around it?
Well, I don't know that I have focused my professional life around it. I would say that culture is a critical piece, but my organization focuses on a wide variety of human capital topics. And, you know, as I look at companies and talk with organizations of all sizes as part of that, it's very clear that culture is a huge indicator of financial success, bottom line business impact, or not. And our research has shown that over the years. I know others have proved that through research over the years. And so, I've always been somewhat fascinated by that fact, and the fact that a lot of folks don't think you can change culture. In fact, my co-founder for quite a long time felt like you couldn't do anything to affect the culture of an organization. Even my father was a very successful businessman and took over an insurance company, several decades ago. He used to tell me that the culture was in the woodwork, meaning that he just had a tough time affecting culture. So I think more than anything, Tobias, it's not so much culture. It was the notion that can culture be changed, and why is changing culture so hard, that really intrigued me.
And I think it's really interested on that point that I think sometimes we fall into the camp of thinking that culture change is easy, that it's just kind of simply stating some values, and then on the other hand that it's impossible. And what I'm thinking in terms of that picture is that, of course, we actually do shape culture all the time. I mean, all the time through how we lead, through how we build our organizations, we do shape culture. So, but I guess the question is whether we do it intentionally or unintentionally.
Right. You know, in fact, what our research shows is that culture change is very hard. Only about 15%, 15% of companies that set out to change their culture will say that they've succeeded. That means there's a very large percentage of companies that set out to change their culture ultimately said they did not succeed in doing so. And that's what really intrigued my research team and intrigued me to start down this path of looking at that 15% and trying to figure out, is there a commonality? Is there a blueprint, if you will, that organizations could follow in order to positively affect the culture overall? And sure enough, we did find a number of commonalities and a pretty defined blueprint that we felt organizations could benefit from. And that was the genesis of the original research that we did and the book itself.
So, and we're really going to dig into that together and talk about what you've learned. But first, I just wanted to ask you, what is perhaps the one thing that you see that organizations often get wrong and that leaders and HR professionals get wrong in how we kind of approach culture that kind of leads to that really bad success rate?
Well, maybe it's the assumption that there's one thing. I don't think there's, we tend to, as human beings, like to be pithy and sum things up into one thing. And I think if there's any learnings from the research study, there's a variety of things that need to be done in order to positively affect culture change. You know, maybe it's just the notion that you can't do it is the one thing that they get wrong. But we'll get into some of the steps that I think are pretty important in order to have positive change.
That's awesome. And I think that is such a helpful thing in itself that maybe the problem is thinking that it is one thing. So I heard an interview that you did on Dr. Brené Brown's Dare to Lead podcast, and I'm sure some of our listeners have heard that as well, and where you talked about your book. And I just immediately love the title and the idea of culture renovation. And I think that words and terms matter immensely, and there are many terms around culture and values that have contributed to misconception. And I think, for example, when we talk about culture change or culture transformation, that it implies sometimes almost the idea that you can replace your culture with a new one just based on defining a set of new values. And or, for example, if you merge two organizations and you say, but now we're going to have this new and new different culture. And I love the idea of culture renovation, since it seems much closer to the reality that we actually take something that exists and we have to build upon that. So what does culture renovation mean to you, and how did you land on that name?
Well, you kind of summed it up right there, you know, what my answer was on the podcast around that. I do think a lot of people use culture transformation as the more popular term. And when we got into the research and looked at that 15% that succeeded, it was very clear none of those companies transform their culture. They don't completely change it or start completely anew. Instead, they renovate their culture. And much like you would renovate an old house, what they were doing was keeping what was unique about their company, what was hard to replace, and improving on the value of the organization for the future, just like you would an old house. And so renovation became a much better descriptor of what these organizations were doing in being true to their values, being true to their purpose, and just changing the organization so that it could better perform in the future.
I love that. Love that. So one, I think, important aspect of thinking about culture as we go into this process of thinking about culture renovation is to picture what success looks like. And I think that we can have all these different images of what a great culture looks like, but I also think that it might very much differ from organization to organization, because it depends on kind of what fits our purpose, what fits our vision and our strategy. But something that we've been looking at a lot on this podcast is the thinking about what is a healthy culture? What is it that leads to perhaps a more ethical culture in an organization? But I wanted to ask you, what are some of the things that you see as defining a healthy or a great culture?
We start right out at the beginning of the book listing out traits of a healthy culture. So let me back up and just tell you a little bit about how we do research. My team of analysts looks at companies and their people practices, and we separate companies by their performance. And so we look at high performance companies over a 5-year time frame and contrast and compare their people practices versus low performance organizations. Now, when we say performance, what we're really talking about are companies that have better revenue growth, profitability, market share, customer satisfaction over that 5-year time horizon versus those low performing organizations. And so that becomes a nice way to look at what practices are really impacting bottom line business, and trying to hone in not only on best practices, and we certainly uncover a lot of those, but what we're very interested in are next practices. And we define next practices as those that really have that strong impact to market performance, but not a lot of companies yet have implemented that particular practice. So in thinking about what makes up a healthy culture, as part of the research study that involved over 7,000 organizations, we asked companies to define or list out from a list of maybe 70 different aspects of culture, what would define your organization? What would define your culture? And we got a pretty clear list based on high performance organizations say this, low performance organizations say this, or wouldn't say it as much as those high performers. And we use that as the index that we that we base the whole study on. So let me give you some examples. Things that high performers would say define their culture better than low performers would be being obsessed with delivering value to our customers, valuing execution and accountability, actively supporting diversity and inclusion, which is one that we just loved, supporting a continuous learning and development environment for all the employees. And that was something I certainly highlighted in the book. I'll just pick out a few others. Valuing societal impact as much as financial impact was another one. Being highly collaborative, valuing transparency. So those were all things that high performing organizations would say, that's an aspect of their culture much more so than low performing.
That's fascinating. And I think it connects with a lot of the themes that we have covered and talked about on this podcast in terms of purpose and a culture of integrity. And so I wanted to dig into the different kind of parts of this blueprint. And I think for many of our listeners, and I know this to be true, that as leaders, as HR, as ethics professionals, you know that there is a need for culture renovation in your organization. You've seen the different indications of that, and you might stand at a place where you're wondering, so how do we go about this? And in your book, you talk about like three different kind of main phases, which is to plan, to build, and to maintain. And I think if we would start, of course, with the first part, which is the plan. And I find that organizations often go into working on their culture without knowing why or what they're trying to accomplish. And I think, I don't know really how this is from an international perspective, but let's say from a Swedish perspective, and we've done some work in the US as well, and I felt that the same thing there, but that so many times, because we have this idea that culture is important, that values are important, we think that it is important to work on it, but we might not really know why. And because we hide behind the idea that it is important, we don't really go to the root of understanding why it is meaningful to us at this point and what we're really trying to accomplish. And you are suggesting that we start by developing a listening strategy. So could you talk a little bit to what that listening strategy can look like and what you think is an important starting point to make sure that we go in to this with kind of as much as possible having our eyes open?
Yeah, let me first just back up and talk about this blueprint. So when I talked about the different steps that we uncovered as part of the research, we came up with 18 very distinct steps that organizations can follow in order to positively affect culture change. Then we divided those steps into three phases that you just outlined: plan, build, and maintain, using that renovation theme of how you should embark on culture change. And so the first step in the plan phase is the listening strategy that you just outlined. Now, the overall plan phase is one that can sometimes get ignored by organizations. They get very excited about wanting to renovate and wanting to make change to their culture. So they kind of leap into the build phase. But all successful companies pretty much focused on the plan phase and did a very good job in the six steps that accompany that phase. So the first one of developing a listening strategy is one that I think is very intuitive to top leaders and organizations, as opposed to assuming you know what the culture is. They instead embark on a journey, if you will, to understand from them not only the employees, but also customers and partners, what are some of the cultural aspects of the organization, what are some of the top issues inside the organization. As a leader, particularly in a larger company, information tends to get filtered as it rises to the top. And that's why I think it's very dangerous for a senior leadership team to assume that they know what's happening. Now, there's a lot of different ways that companies can listen to the employees. During this pandemic, it certainly has become much more popular to survey the employee base and gather employee sentiment through those surveys on a frequent basis so that you can understand what are ongoing issues. I say frequent because I think a lot of companies have in the past done annual engagement surveys, for instance, and that's a point in time survey. You can get some good information out of it, but you have to recognize it is a point in time, which means that you can run into false positives. You know, there might be some hot issue at the moment that the survey was delivered that dissipates over time. And that's why it's important to have more frequent surveys, more frequent listening, so that you can see, you know, what are the lasting issues versus what are those sort of point in time issues. I get very excited about some technology that's helping in this regard. So there's a number of companies that are using what's called natural language processing, or NLP, to allow employees to write in their own words what they're feeling about, you know, whatever questions you're asking or about the culture itself. And then allowing the technology to use artificial intelligence and a little machine learning to parse what employees are saying and categorize it into useful categories for senior leaders. That is allowing those large companies to not have to read through every individual comment and then try to manually categorize it, which is what they've done in the past. We often will be too general when we do that and just lump things under categories like communication or leadership, as opposed to getting into more specific categories around what was it about leadership that, you know, the employees are saying, and be able to really track what the true employee sentiment is. More and more companies are beginning to use this new technology, and it's in a variety of different tool sets to listen to the workforce. Some companies are even using this as an always-on platform. So it doesn't have to be time-bound. It's not just instigated by a survey. They can express their viewpoints whenever they would like to express their viewpoints, which I think can be also very valuable. During the pandemic, we've seen companies amp up the number of surveys that they're putting out there. Some companies, and I wrote about this in the book, are doing that on a daily basis. Amazon is one company I called out, where before you log on in the morning to your laptop, your computer, you are asked one question, and it becomes almost habit to just answer the one question and then get on with your day, which I kind of like. But they use that question very strategically. And the question that I referenced in the book that got a lot of attention is your manager a simplifier or a complexifier? And I like that question a lot, because not only are you gathering some interesting data, but you're also you're helping managers think about their own style. So as they're answering that question, they're thinking, you know, am I simplifying things for my team, or am I making it more complex? And And Amazon has often done that. They set sort of a tone or a discussion point for the organization throughout the day, whether it's D&I related or what have you, to not only gather data, but, you know, get a conversation going that could be constructive. So the listening aspect, I think, is a critical one to really understand what's happening with the workforce. Even today, with companies struggling with things like when do we return to office, or vaccine mandates, we're seeing a number of companies recognize the importance of listening. Let's not just do what, you know, what's in our gut. Let's really understand what's important to the workforce before we make broad policy decisions.
That is so, so helpful. And I'm thinking that it's so important to distinguish, I guess, between kind of the what is more the climate information and what is more the culture information in that sense. And what are some ways that you think it's helpful to do that?
Yeah, so those are listening to the workforce to really understand what the climate is a good one to do it. There's a lot of ways that you can gauge that climate through focus groups inside the organization. We talked about culture hackathons that some companies put into place to really draw out, you know, the opinions of the workforce. But yeah, really understanding that first before you make any policy decisions is critical.
So as you move on from that listening phase, and or I guess we should say that you should never move on from it. It's something that you constantly need to be doing, and you need to have that listening strategy always in place and have ways of doing that continually. And I guess that's also perhaps one of the issues, that we do it as a one-time thing, and then we think that we can just move on from there. But as you've been listening, as you start seeing, okay, here are certain things that we might need to address. So what are some of the next steps that you suggest that people take in this kind of planning phase?
Yeah, so there's a couple of critical ones, but I'll just run through the steps for the audience. So the second one is figuring out what to keep. That's just really understanding what is unique to the organization and what's absolutely something that we need to hold on to as an organization before the third step, which is setting your cultural path and really deciding what do we want out of our culture going forward. Defining the behaviors that we want to see from our leaders, that's always a critical one. But I want to spend a little bit of time on the fifth one, which is identifying the influencers and energizers inside the organization. A critical component for companies that want to have long-lasting culture change is to recognize that there are certain people inside the company that have greater influence over the workforce than others. And we all have worked with people like this in our lives, where there's a person who seems to have all the subject matter expertise. They're the go-to person within your department, your division, maybe your office setup. They sometimes not only have all the information, but they energize people, right? And we all have folks like this, where you talk to somebody and you leave that conversation just fired up. You leave it energized, and you're a better person after the conversation than you were going into it. Whereas there's also the opposite. There are people who just kind of suck the life out of you when you talk to them, and you leave somewhat depressed. It's important, if you want to have long-lasting culture change at the ground level, understand who those influencers are, who those energizers are, and then engage them as culture ambassadors in the efforts that you're trying to put forward. Now, you uncover those people through a science called organizational network analysis. And it's a science that we've used quite a bit and are big proponents of. The father of this is a professor at Babson College just outside of Boston in the U.S. His name is Rob Cross. In fact, Rob is just coming out with a new book that really highlights how you use organizational network analysis around collaboration and to avoid collaboration overload. But what organizational network analysis does is asks employees in the organization, who are your go-to people? Who do you need more time from if you could get it? Who are the people that give you energy? And conversely, who are the people that take energy away from you? And almost always that analysis doesn't map to the hierarchy, meaning that the leader in the organization or the person at the top of the typical org chart is not the person that everybody gets energy from and turns to. It's usually somebody buried in the hierarchy. And it's important to do this analysis because leaders often miss those energizers, those influencers. They don't always know who they are. Sometimes those people are very buried in the hierarchy, and sometimes those people are introverts. They're not extroverts, and so they don't necessarily stand out. Until you take the time to really map this out, you're not going to know exactly who should be a culture ambassador going forward. And so I think that's a critical step. And we saw several companies that were successful enlist and engage those culture ambassadors all over the world in their organizations and through all kinds of different departments and divisions and business units in the organization to make sure that they were influencing people, you know, at all levels around the culture change you were trying to enact. So that step, I think, is an important one, identifying the influencers and energizers. And the last step in the plan phase was just determining how you're going to measure your progress overall. And we found that the successful companies, they took the time to think about that. You know, how do we know if we've been successful or not? And there's a variety of ways you can measure that, but they set up the mechanisms to do so up front. 90% of the companies who are unsuccessful at changing their culture skipped that step. They didn't bother to think about how are we going to determine our progress going forward. So that was another critical one in that plan phase, Tobias.
Thank you so much for that, Kevin. And I think that's extremely helpful. And I just wanted to circle back to one of the other steps of this plan, which is which you mentioned briefly, which is define the desired behaviors. And there's something that you said that I really liked that I found really insightful, that you define the desired behaviors for your leadership and for your leaders, and that you start that process at the top. And I think that so many times when organizations work on culture renovation, it's very easy to go into the mode of, okay, now we're going to define how our team members should behave. And we go out and we try to kind of teach them, or we invite somebody in to come and speak to them about that behavior. But they then feel that there's no real integrity in this organization around this, because I don't see that those behaviors from my managers, and I don't see that type of behavior is actually rewarded in this organization. Could you just say something more about that point and what you found in your research on that?
Yeah, I think employees will emulate what leadership does, not what's written on a PowerPoint or, you know, framed on a wall. And so it's important, I think, when you're thinking about the culture that we want in the organization, the behaviors that enable that culture need to be exhibited by leaders at all levels, not just senior leadership, which we tend to overly focus on at times, but it's leaders at the mid-level and frontline leaders as well. And so companies that were successful in changing culture, we talk about this later in the build phase, they provided training on the desired behaviors and what they expected at all those levels, and put a lot of energy into making that happen. But first, you have to define those leadership behaviors. And I highlighted certain companies like F5 Networks, which is a wonderful company headquartered in Seattle, Washington, that their CEO has done a great job in combination with the CHRO at really understanding what behaviors matter inside the organization. And it became, again, a mixture of behaviors that had always, you know, had always been present, or the company had always identified with, along with some behaviors for the future, some new behaviors. And they settled on those as a management team. They wrote those up. They published those. Then they began the long, hard process of training all leaders inside the organization to make sure they understood those behaviors and lived them. And I think that's really what it takes to have a great long-lasting culture change, is to make sure that it doesn't get inadvertently, you know, sideways just by having certain managers not live up to what you're trying to accomplish overall as an organization.
That's awesome. So when you have then developed your listening strategy, you figured out what to keep, you set your cultural path, you defined the desired behavior, you've identified the influencers, you determine how progress is going to be measured. So what is the next step that is important to take as you start to move into the build phase?
So there are six steps in that build phase, and I'll just quickly run through those. One is clearly communicate that change is coming. The next one is ferret out the skeptics and the non-believers early. I'm going to come back to that one. Paint a vision for the future. Consciously collaborate. Establish a co-creation mindset, a lot like what I was describing earlier on. And then what I just mentioned, provide training on those desired behaviors. Now, I said I wanted to come back to the ferreting out the skeptics and non-believers. Of all the steps, that might be the most challenging one. Yet we found in most successful organizations, to a certain extent, they found it necessary to make sure that they either converted skeptics around the culture change or moved them aside, sometimes out of the organization, in order to accomplish what they set out to do. It's a lot like what Jim Collins wrote about in Good to Great, you know, just getting the right people on the bus to begin with. It can be very damaging to have people, certainly in a senior role, be, you know, subverting what you're trying to do from a culture change effort and, you know, being skeptics down below the organization, but sometimes kind of hiding in plain sight. Sometimes it's not easy to ascertain who's a skeptic and who's not. Skeptics usually are that way because they feel like their power is being usurped or somehow challenged. Maybe they're losing some territory, what have you. Or maybe they just don't believe in what you're trying to accomplish from a culture change perspective. But if you don't get them out of the way, they can very quickly derail the whole effort. And I quoted several CEOs who said, look, I didn't think going in I'd need to replace a bunch of people on my team around this culture change that we were trying to enact. But in the end, that's what I ended up having to do in order to make sure it stuck. And so it's not an easy step by any stretch. I even in the chapter in the book in which I talk about it, I wrote about Bob Sutton's book called The No Asshole Rule, which is, you know, a relatively simple concept, but the ends doesn't justify the means is basically what Bob writes about, and how destructive that brilliant jerk can be inside the organization. You know, we've all run into these people in our careers as well, somebody who's extremely successful at what they do or gets results, but there's a lot of collateral damage along the way from them. And so that collateral damage can really impact the culture of an organization, and you can't tolerate the individual execution excellence of these people if they are just ruining the culture, you know, while trying to get their, trying to ultimately accomplish their goals. And so that's really what we talk about in that particular chapter.
And I think that is such an incredibly important point. And also as working with lots of different organizations, and I think maybe perhaps specifically in the public sector, I see that this is a really, really challenging point, and that we often have people that we know about. We know that they are perhaps exhibiting behaviors that really create an unhealthy climate or in their teams and really send signals into the organization that are totally in conflict with what we're trying to accomplish. But if we look at this from a European context, then firing people is often not the easiest thing to do because of labor laws and so on. What would you say to organizations where that is not perhaps a simple or, I mean, where it's not that easy to do, right?
Yeah, I'm not advocating, to be clear, I'm not advocating just fire somebody. I think there's a lot of steps you take before you get to that stage. One, the best step is to convince them, right? And to get them on board and engaged with the culture change effort that you're trying to put in place. If that can't happen, then, trying to reduce the damage that can be done, I guess, by those people by, you know, moving them aside is another step that, or another tactic that companies have used. regardless of what the tactic is, it's just important to make sure you understand who those skeptics are. And a lot of times companies don't necessarily understand that. Again, the surveying techniques and the organizational network analysis technique that I mentioned earlier is a way to uncover that. Yeah, so Tobias, we've all had these kind of folks in our career, I certainly have, where the sun always shines up and you get one version of truth from individuals, but oftentimes it can be a hurricane below that person. That's why I think doing skip level meetings and just really committing to understanding employee sentiment through those listening strategies that we talked about is important. Then you get a much fuller picture and you can understand what's happening in the workforce. And that's such a big part of that step of just ferreting out those skeptics is really understanding who the skeptics are to begin with. And so I know this isn't an easy step to deal with, but an important one to make sure that culture change sticks.
And I'm just thinking, connected to that step, that I think it's so important that sometimes when we want to run through a change, something that I've seen in organizations is that we think that people are the kind of, if we would say, the skeptics that we cannot convert, we decide that very quickly. So we just want to kind of push them to the side and we don't actually take the time to really listen to their thoughts and perspectives that might be valid. And I'm just thinking, how do we kind of distinguish between that so that we don't just, okay, you don't agree with me or you don't see things the way I do, so I'm just going to run on in my own way.
Yeah, I think in a lot of healthy organizations, they recognize that differing opinions and debate are important. We've seen that in many organizations where they will call out the fact that we can agree to disagree, but let's all come to agreement and then move on once that debate has been heard. That's, I think, a skill of very good leaders, is to make it psychologically safe for people to share dissenting viewpoints, to accept those dissenting viewpoints. I always like the quote that I came across recently called, be curious, not judgmental. And I think that goes into that philosophy of just really trying to ferret out everybody's viewpoint and make it safe for them to share that so that you as a team can then move on.
So as we then move on from that, your next step is to paint a vision for the future. And where do you kind of want to take us next?
Yeah, I as part of that chapter in the book, I talked a lot about the notion of putting out a North Star for the organization, talking about where you want the organization to go versus harping on the mistakes of the past. And I highlighted some different leaders in that particular chapter that came into an organization. And I think it's very tempting to do this, to initially talk about all the things that went wrong. And that's why you have a new leader to begin with, usually, and why you're, oftentimes it's a catalyst for why you want to change culture, as opposed to acknowledging all the hard work that went into the organization to make it as successful as it had been, and then painting that vision for what you want to see the organization become long term. And there's some great stories and examples throughout the book, but I think in that particular chapter, we had some pretty good examples of leaders that did that very effectively, and leaders who didn't do that very effectively, and what the outcome was.
I think that is really fascinating, and I've worked with some organizations that have really gone through a crisis and a scandal, and where trust has been broken, and in those situations, I've seen that there's been this need to be able to rebuild trust and to be able to move forward towards a new kind of vision of what the culture could look like and how behaviors and ideas need to shift, that it's been important to both honor the hard work, as you said, of that has been kind of done in the past, but it's also been important to kind of recognize, not to put blame on anyone, which I think is really important not to do, but to recognize where the culture had gone wrong in the past, because some of those things, they needed to be addressed, they needed to be acknowledged, and they needed to actually been even though the leadership might be new, they still needed to take a responsibility for that to be able to shift kind of the focus into the future. What's your perspective on that?
You know, I highlighted several different companies that have underwent some pretty tough times, and why culture was blamed in those instances. So, for example, the tragedies of the Boeing 737 MAX crashes was ultimately blamed on a culture of concealment, where engineers did not feel psychologically safe to call out issues or call out concerns to leaders in the organization. And the U.S. House of Representatives was the one that that blamed the culture on those crashes. The same was true for the Wells Fargo sales scandals. You know, the culture that existed in the sales organization around incentives that they could get caused some unethical behavior that went unchecked inside that organization. And so, all of that, I think, is important for organizations to recognize that they don't always have a good handle on some of the cultural nuances that are happening in the company. I've talked to a number of board members, chairs of boards and directors about this as well. And there's been a renewed interest over the last few years from boards of directors in really understanding the culture of the organizations that they are governing. We've probably over-architected a bit on financial acumen, and we have probably a dearth of human capital acumen on many boards. And so there's a lot of ex-CHROs or current heads of HR being asked to sit on public boards or large corporate boards for that very reason. In fact, some companies are even setting up culture subcommittees off of the board, much like you'd have the audit committee and the governance committee. They're setting up a culture subcommittee so that they can come back to the board with real measures and real information around the culture of the company. Too often, the perception of culture by the board is almost entirely filtered through what the CEO is saying about the culture, or maybe, you know, a couple other key executives versus some of those objective measures. And so I think that's going to be an important thing going forward.
That's really helpful. So as we move on from, or we start to paint this vision of the future, you talk about the need then in the next step to consciously collaborate, and then the step again to establish this co-creation mindset, which I really would want to talk to you about. But let's just take us through these steps at your pace and highlight what you think is perhaps especially important for us to take out. And then, of course, we should all go and I already have it, but everyone else should go and get the book and read it and to get into it further.
Yeah, well, so those steps, consciously collaborate, is based on research that my team has done on purposeful collaboration. And what we found in high-performing organizations is very few of them let collaboration just happen and don't try to manage it. The high-performing organizations, they're very purposeful in how collaboration is happening inside the company, what it's used for, and how they can enable it. And so we talk about some of those techniques in the consciously collaborate aspect, and it's such an important one for getting culture right. The same is true for co-creation mindset. While culture change absolutely has to be leader-led, you're not going to get anywhere if you don't get the cooperation of the workforce and of the employee base. So, we talked earlier about the culture ambassador perspective. Getting the culture ambassadors to elicit opinions, ideas, et cetera, from the workforce and put those as part of what's happening with the culture change was all talked about in that particular chapter around a co-creation mindset. So I'm a big believer in using hackathons or focus groups or other techniques to get the workforce involved in building what you're trying to build. So that was really covered in that step.
Awesome. And could you just give an example of an organization that you think have done a great job of creating that co-creation mindset within the organization and perhaps used one of these tactics that you talked about?
Yeah, in one of the chapters, I highlight a pharmaceutical company, AbbVie, which was a spin-out from Abbott Labs. And it's an interesting case study. Abbott Labs had had a very distinct culture, but they spun out AbbVie with tens of thousands of employees, and they had a unique opportunity to create a culture from scratch. And the CEO and CHRO did a great job at enlisting a number of culture ambassadors, and then throughout the world, enlisting the workforce to provide ideas around what they wanted to see going forward from a culture perspective.
I think so many times we'll go into the process of working with culture renovation or culture change, and we'll set a number of different kind of tactics and things or activities. And then when we run through that list, we think that we're done. And I really want to talk about the aspect of maintaining. How do we make sure that what we're doing is actually becoming ingrained in how we operate as an organization, how we make decisions, how we promote the right people, and so on. So could you talk a little bit about the maintain phase and what are some, and of course we don't have time to dig into all of it, but just some things that you think are especially important to think about in making sure that we maintain what we have started to the vision that we're working towards.
Yeah, if not enough attention is paid to this, it's easy for the company to sort of drift back to the way things used to be. And so there's a lot of talent activities in the maintain phase around onboarding new employees, promoting those who best represent the new, looking at your performance management practices and making sure that those align with the culture change you're trying to put into place. And something I just wrote about in Harvard Business Review, the importance of talent mobility and moving people around the organization, particularly your top performers. Those are all aspects of the maintain phase. And this is where I think it really highlights the importance of the HR team in culture change efforts. You know, the HR team is often responsible for a lot of those things in the maintain phase. And, you know, enlisting their help and making sure that they're completely involved in the culture renovation effort is critical. I'll just talk about that talent mobility one for a second, Tobias, because I did write that article. What we find in a lot of low performing organizations is they let managers hoard talent. And it's kind of a natural thing. If you've got really good people on your team or in your department division, you want to keep them. You don't want them going anywhere. High performing organizations recognize the importance of moving that talent throughout the organization. Collaboration improves, productivity improves, but just overall, from a culture change perspective, you get a more unified culture when that happens versus silos and these microcultures that every organization has. For the individual, for talent, you know, in a talent mobility program, they get a much more well-rounded experience of the company. They develop, they often get promoted through this process. And so it can be a very rewarding aspect for the individual. Too often in companies, when managers want to hire somebody, we make it easier for them to go outside the organization to hire somebody versus looking internally for that person. The same thing happens for individuals when they're interested in looking at a new position. Too often we make it easier for them to go outside the company than to look within the company for a new role a new responsibility. So talent mobility is one that I'm a big fan of and we find is a hallmark of high performing companies for sure.
So of course, HR plays an incredibly important role here. And I really, really am grateful for the way that you show that through your research. And I know that many of our listeners are HR leaders. But I'm just thinking that one aspect also of this culture renovation is that sometimes it becomes this project for the HR team. And even as we talk about maintaining, that it becomes just about the kind of the talent and processes or the HR processes within the organization. What are some other kind of things in terms of maintaining that you see that are maybe outside of the typical HR processes that are important to to take into account?
Well, you know, I think first it's an attitude that culture change is never done. And that's the way I end the book. You know, you can't just stick a flag in the ground and say, okay, we did it. We changed our culture. Let's move on. It's a process, and the most successful companies are always working at their culture. In fact, I start out the book with a pretty in-depth profile of Microsoft and their wonderful renovation of their overall culture under Satya Nadella's leadership and Kathleen Hogan, who's the head of HR there. But Microsoft is the first to tell you, while we've had a lot of success at changing our culture, there are aspects of our culture that we need to be constantly working on. And that's throughout the organization. It's not all on the shoulders of HR. And I never advocate that a company should say, hey, HR, this is your responsibility to change culture. Or I often kind of cringe when I see people in charge of culture inside of an organization, because no one person can be in charge of culture, really, other than the CEO. Ultimately, the CEO is the one who's going to set the tone and make this happen. But it takes a village, and it takes a lot of people to make it happen. So, you know, again, it's throughout the organization, whether you're talking about operations or manufacturing or sales, or, you know, it depends on the type of company that you are. You need cooperation from a lot of different levels, but they all have to be working in unison towards that North Star. And that's why it's so important to communicate what it is you're trying to accomplish, what the purpose of the organization is, and have everybody rally around that.
So in a number of the examples, let's say you mentioned Satya Nadella at Microsoft. Some years ago, I interviewed Frank Blake, who led a big transformation at the Home Depot a number of years ago, which really was in big part, I would say, a culture renovation effort there to go back to some of the things that they had lost from the past, which really led to some big positive change. But what I see in those examples is that we have this kind of inspiring senior leader, a senior leader who is able to really cast vision, to really create clarity around what's important, what we should celebrate as an organization. And then I also meet a lot of HR leaders who have gotten kind of this on their table that they should work on different aspects of the culture, but they feel like they miss that support from the top. They feel like they miss that support from maybe a leader who really sets out the direction, but they're more just given this project or this task to run. What are some of the things that you could say to people who are in that position in terms of how to deal with that? And is it important, or is it possible to bring that change, even though you might not have a Satya Nadella or Frank Blake or somebody else at the top?
But buy that person the book and show them examples and in what the research says, you know, around having that support. I always think the best way to convince senior leadership is to use data to your advantage. You know, much like we've talked about, data from high performing organizations certainly can help convince people about the importance of certain aspects. And then use examples from companies that they either respect or even fear, so that they understand what's happening, you know, with other organizations. You know, ultimately, it needs to be a partnership between a lot of different folks inside the organization. But the one that I highlight the most in the book is the partnership between senior leadership and the HR group. And that it's very, very clear in the 15% that succeeded that partnership existed. And so, you know, I think it's important to make sure get that in place for sure.
So, Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time. And I wanted to ask you as a final question, what are ways that people can connect with you and follow your work?
Well, we set up a whole separate website for the book. It's at culturerenovation.com. There's a number of tools and case studies, and there's a monthly newsletter that you can subscribe to that are outside of what you'll find in the book. So if you're a fan of the book, or if you're just thinking, you know, maybe I want to read this book, but want to do some additional research before I get it, that's a good place to start. Otherwise, I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter, and certainly people can follow me there. And then the company that I run, the website is i4cp.com. That's I, the number four, cp.com.
So thank you again, Kevin, and can really recommend everyone to get the book. And thank you, Kevin, for the important work that you and your organization do to create more healthy cultures, or as we talk about on this podcast, about creating cultures of purpose, trust, and integrity. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.